UCR Office of Public Information. Questions by Henry Mendoza. Interview, Dr. Francis Carney of the Department of Political Science at UCR. Dr. Carney, what seems to be the political mood of the country?
If I had to use a single word, I'd probably say expectant, anticipatory, waiting, one of those words, because I think most people, without necessarily being experts in political analysis or historians or even notably interested in what's going on every day, have the sense that we're entering some kind of changing time, that this is a period in which old figures in politics symbolically will be making their last go round, and new people are coming along. I think they will bring some new ideas with them, and I think the country is waiting to see what shape the newer politics of the last quarter of the 20th century is going to take. That's about the best I can say about that.
Do you think the economy is going to influence voters this year?
From everything we know about the American voter, the economy always influences a large number of American voters. For one thing we know is that there is a huge block of voters, amounting to maybe a third, between a quarter and a third of the total number of voters, who really aren't all that interested in parties, candidates, don't pay close attention to politics. What they do is they respond almost with their fingertips and their bodies to the goodness or badness of the times, as we put it, and vote accordingly. They vote for the party in power when the times are good, and they vote against the party in power when the times are bad. So in that sense, the economy always influences all presidential elections. I think this one, it may be more decisively influential, but that depends on a number of things. It depends on how swift and complete the recovery is. It depends in part on what people's memories of the 2 to 2.5 year recession or downturn was like. And it depends upon the extent to which the Democrats nominate a candidate who comes out of the old Democratic center, out of the old Labor New Deal, academic liberal economist tradition of the Democratic Party, out of the Hubert Humphrey tradition. I would say a Humphrey, a Jackson, would dwell heavily on the economy, would dwell heavily on Democratic plans for full employment and the like. Democrats never worry too much about inflation, but if the inflation hasn't stopped, they will argue that it is the unemployment that is the most serious and drastic consequence of the inflation. So I would think the economy will be important in those ways. I mean, Ford will, of course, if he's the nominee, as I assume he will be, of the Republican Party, if the recovery is going on apace, will seek rightly enough to take credit for that. And there will be a large number of people who will say, all right, things aren't so bad. Things are better than they were a year ago, and I'm going to vote for Jerry Ford. I think it will work that way.
You spoke to this before. Are we in or approaching an era of new politics? Is a new political ethic being developed or emerging?
Well, we're always entering an era of new politics. It seems all ages are transitional ages. We're always in passage from one time to another. But for some time now, serious commentators and observers of the American political scene have been talking about, if not the bankruptcy, then the irrelevancy of some of the basic old conflicts of the 30s, 40s, 50s, some of the conflicts which divided liberal from conservative or left from right and Democrat from Republican, having to do with government spending, government responsibility for certain parts of the economy, the provision of welfare, the regulation of business and other interests in the name of the general or public interest. Those old conflicts have been largely settled. I don't think anybody. I think the defeat of Goldwater and 1964. And if you need more proof, the abysmal failure of Reagan, although he started with a lead over Ford in the polls to get anywhere in his campaigning, those things, it seems to me, indicate those old arguments are dead, and that the Republican right wing of the 30s or 40s no longer exists or is really not relevant in politics anymore. At the same time, the confidence of the liberal Democrats from Roosevelt on that every problem facing the country could somehow be solved by government, by action of the federal government from Washington, or by action of government generally, has been seriously modified. I think the main thing that American liberalism has always had from the beginning is a strong measure of confidence that there was no problem which could not be solved by ingenuity, intelligence, rational planning, governmental action, and so forth. A lot of that confidence is gone from American liberalism. So that means that the left wing of the Democrats are sort of floundering, because their old nostrums and formulas about, well, let's create a body to regulate business here, or to enforce civil rights there, or to stimulate the economy here, or provide job training. Those kinds of things no longer seem to be so successful as they were. They're the confidence that those things are going to get us out of our troubles. They're going to solve that with a few governmental commissions and some stimulation of the economy and a few job training programs and some commissions to enforce non-discriminatory legislation. All of the evil consequences of 400 years of vicious discrimination against blacks are going to be wiped out with no pain for anybody. I mean, that childish dream has gone down the tubes for everybody. That means there's a general feeling of pessimism from the Democratic left. The old Republican right is irrelevant. The Democratic left is floundering and wondering where to go next. So, yes, we are entering, I think, an era of new politics.
Although it is probably too early to put this political era in historical perspective, would you make an educated guess as to how historians in the future will look back at all that has occurred in the U.S. after Vietnam?
I think about that a lot and try to make summaries of it for my classes. I've tried to write it here and there about what the 60s and early 70s have meant, what really happened during all that time. And I have to confess that I don't come up with any really confident generalizations about the period. I think that the New Left, which was the most striking phenomenon of the 60s, of the most striking political phenomenon of the 60s, was not the hopeless total bust that everybody now says it was, because it seems to have disappeared without a trace, and those young people who are political are generally active in the Democratic and Republican parties rather than in militant protest or alternative politics and the like. That sense that nothing happened or nothing really was accomplished in the 60s, I think is wrong. I think I would say with some confidence, and I know this seems like a paradox, but I'm going to say it anyway, with some confidence I would say that the whole political spectrum shifted a few degrees to the left as a result of the 60s. I think that equalitarian ideas got deeply set. I think that it'll never again be the same for women, for example. All authority got challenged in the 1960s. All authority got challenged. My authority as a professor got challenged, and it's never going to be quite the same again. Governmental authority got challenged, had to justify itself in rational terms, in terms of what it accomplished, and so on. That, it'll take a long time for those changes to die out, just as I don't think what's happened for women, partially as a result of the general opening and loosening of things of the 60s, is ever going to be lost. I mean, women have broken out of some kind of a confinement. You and I might or might not like that, or we might or might not like all of the manifestations of it. And I don't like some of them just personally, but I think that the 60s and the 70s have meant that change there. I think also that I mentioned equalitarian ideas getting deeply set as a result of the 60s and 70s, and some of the agitation and ideas of the New Left. And What I mean by that is I think that in hugely increased numbers of people, and particularly people who were young in the 60s and 70s, will never again easily accept gross inequalities of condition, of station, of life as being somehow natural and inevitable or right or good. They may put up with them, but they will not believe that they are right, that they are sown in the nature of things and so on. I think that people younger than myself, certainly people in their 30s and still in their 20s perhaps, really have become committed to something like a fairly radical, fairly thoroughgoing egalitarianism. There are other things about the 60s and 70s, the post-Vietnam thing. I think American foreign policy has been deeply and permanently affected by Vietnam. I think that Kissinger laments now, I think correctly, that is to say, he is right in his observation, that the consensus about foreign policy, which has existed since Truman's days, since 1945, 46, 47, when Truman and Acheson and George Marshall set down the basic outlines of contemporary American foreign policy, part of that consensus was that the United States not only would be able to, but ought to, use its power as a kind of balancing, countervailing force everywhere and around the world to push back, halt, restrain, check, frustrate communist or socialist expansion, and that it was right that we should do so. That was a fundamental part of that foreign policy consensus, and I think that has been, if not permanently altered, then called into serious question as a result of Vietnam. We tried to do that. We made a step to do that. It was in order to make our power felt, to correct what we called a pathology, namely the spread of nationalist communism out of Hanoi to all of Southeast Asia, to correct that, we had to use our power, our force, and we discovered that it was hard for us to do so and that we weren't willing to do it finally, that we weren't willing to pay that much of a price for carrying out that kind of an American mission. Kissinger will say this is a terrible thing that's happened. I'm not so sure it's terrible that's happened. I'm not so sure that the consensus of 1945 to the present was a correct consensus. It may be that we can't and ought not to try to push back, quote, communism, unquote, everywhere it appears all around the world. It may be that something like communist or socialist national revolutions are going to take place in some parts of the world, and there isn't anything we can really do about it, or maybe even ought to do about it. I'm not totally sure of that, but I think enough people, as a result of the Vietnamese War, now share a view similar to that of mine, that we can say that foreign policy has been permanently changed as a result of those years. Finally, the last thing that seems to me to have happened as a result of those years is a direct challenge to a particular kind of authority in America. Now, I've said that all authority was challenged, scrutinized, forced to justify itself in the 60s and 70s. But a particular kind of authority, by which I mean the authority of science, of rationality, of belief in the possibility of objective knowledge of the world and of the universe and so forth, the authority of that view of reality, I think, was challenged by the events of the 1960s, by the counterculture, if you please. I mean, Americans have always been an enormously practical, pragmatic, down-to-earth, empirical people, people who believe that reality was what you sense, feel, touch, and that the only way you knew what reality was to sense things, feel things, touch things. They didn't believe much in mysticism and so forth. They believe in hard, practical things, great respect for science, technology, for rational approaches to things, and so on. I believe that there was that in some way to the younger generation of the 1960s and 70s, it seemed as though the authors of the Vietnamese War reasoned that way, used that kind of approach to reality, that is to say, the practical, down-to-earth, empirical, logical approach to understanding the world, and that approach took them into the disastrous course in Vietnam. And so that kind of
the authority of science, of rationality, of practical knowing, I think, was challenged by the 60s. And the result of it we see so far, right now only, the short-term result of it seems to be all those things that someone my age looks upon as aberrant. The promiscuous running after this guru or that, and the belief in sudden the explosion of beliefs and or attraction to Eastern or Asian philosophies, to the mystical, in my view, astrology and things like that, all are expressions of a loss of confidence in or a weakening of the authority of science, rationality, practicality, the Western view of nature and reality. Long way around to answer a question.
Who would you say will be the final two candidates on the November ballot, and who do you think will win that election?
Well, I think the Republicans will nominate Ford, and I really, at this stage, right now, without being able to give all of the reasons why I think it's the case, because it would just take an hour to explain it, I believe the Democrats will nominate Humphrey, and it will be a Humphrey-Ford contest. And that seems paradoxical, because here I'm talking about a new politics, and we're entering an era of new politics, and yet it seems to me we will have a last hurrah for the old, that both Ford and Humphrey are preeminently people of men of the politics of the last quarter century. They really both go, it's a hard thing to realize, but Humphrey and Ford go back to the Harry Truman era of American politics. They came into politics at that time, so that they will, I think, be the nominees. And which will win? My sense is the Democrats will win. I think Humphrey will win. But I believe in a campaign that's halfway well financed at all, that Humphrey or any other reasonable Democrat will be able to mobilize all of the doubts and reservations people have about Ford and invoke all of the confidence they have in the Democrats, who after all are the party which is committed to government and the use of government and for problem solving. So I think that's my hunch. Now, of course, it's going to turn out that Ford will not even get the Republican. He'll quit in the next month, and the Democrats will nominate somebody who has even a not Jerry Brown or someone like that, and who knows who will win in November.
Questions by Henry Mendoza. Interviewing Dr. Francis Carney, Department of Political Science. Interview: A Glimpse at Governor Brown in California Politics. Dr. Carney, does Governor Brown really represent something new in politics?
That's such a hard question to answer with any modesty at all. Just to answer the question whether anybody represents something new in politics is sort of to flirt with the notion that, well, it's unprecedented and there's never been anybody quite like it before. And there's also, in attempting to answer that question, some sense that one knows what the future is going to be like, and that therefore one can say, well, this man or these people or this movement is the future. And I quickly want to disavow any claim to having a clear picture of the future. But finally then, having said made all those reservations, yes, I think Brown does represent something new in politics. The Brown is a liberal Democrat. He is not unaffected by the tradition of democratic liberalism, which goes back to Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt and Truman and so on. And yet, he is what I have called elsewhere in another article the first major post-New Deal democratic liberal, by which I mean he is a liberal in the sense that he believes that it is possible and necessary to take social action against social injustice. At the same time, he no longer believes that the New Deal formula of creating from Washington and administering from Washington programs of reform automatically are going to produce the end to those social injustices. He is apt to see social injustice as more deeply rooted and deeply caused than liberals of an earlier generation were apt to have seen it. Therefore, he is more inclined to be skeptical about what government can do to eradicate social justice. He is more inclined to be looking for answers rather than claiming right now that he knows what the answers are.
Does the emergence of new candidates like Tom Hayden mean our political system is opening up?
Yes, I think it means that our political system is opening. I was very pleased to see Tom Hayden get into the race, not because I think he ought to beat John Tunney or because he ought to beat or he ought to win in the Democratic nomination and beat whoever the Republican nominee might be and go on, but because it's good to see people like Hayden leaving alternative politics, so to speak, and getting into main politics. I think the people of California should hear what Tom Hayden has to say. He's going to learn a lot about what the people of California really like. He's going to discover that there are a lot of people besides Berkeley out there in this country, in this state, and that they're real too, and they have hopes and fears and ideals and values, and that they've all got to be understood and dealt with. So both Hayden will learn a lot, and I think the state will learn a lot.
How do you explain Governor Brown's apparently unprecedented popularity?
I don't know for sure it's why he is so popular. I had a hunch that he might become popular once people began to pay attention to what he was really like, because one did know at least that he really had few illusions about the political order and very little regard for either the excessive use of language that characterizes politics, the overly emotional use of language, the use of hyperbolic terms to describe really pretty tiny, pretty petty things. It always distressed him, and then he also had the sense that everybody in politics is overrated, including presidents and governors, and that it's no big deal for him that he drives, that he has a Plymouth instead of a Cadillac or something fancier, and that he pays his own rent and lives in a relatively modest apartment, and yes, he does sleep in a mattress on the floor, and so on. I mean, I thought that once people got to see those things about him, that they would get to like him a little bit more. And then also, I think that you have to understand how really awful politics seemed during Watergate. I mean, it really just did seem just terrible. And there have been enough things after Watergate to make anybody sick at the thought of the politician who feathers his own nest, who gets rich while in office, who's got his eye cocked all the time for his own main chance, and so on. I mean, that vision of the politician is one that just literally finally disgusted people. And Brown has fairly successfully managed to divest himself of any resemblance to that figure in politics. And I think that accounts for his great popularity. I know that when Brown was running for the governorship, I was writing an article about that particular race, about California politics at that time. And I went out up in Sacramento, I went out in the Carmichael area, in L.A., out in the San Fernando Valley, and then out here in the upland Rialto area. Went door to door to talk to people about what they thought about Brown and what they thought about his opponent Flournoy and the general state of politics and so on. Well, you remember that was just after Nixon had resigned and Ford had just pardoned Nixon, and the almost snarling resentment against all politicians that people expressed overwhelmingly. It was something unprecedented to me. I'd never seen anything like it before. I never felt such fury and contempt and loathing for politics as was expressed in that particular set of interviews. And when I asked people about Jerry Brown or Flournoy, they said, "No, to hell with both of them. They're both politicians. I don't care which one. Tell me Pat Brown's running again?" And they would say things like that. So that he wasn't even known before he became governor, and I think it's because of closer concentration on the kind of person he really is that his popularity has come. Then he has a sense of humor, There's a sense of playfulness about Brown that's really kind of engaging. And he is, in some incredible way, very accessible. I mean, that if you're ever up in Sacramento during the Reagan or even the Pat Brown years, now Pat Brown was a genial, good-natured, outgoing fellow, but even when he was governor, the governor's office was never that hubbub, that center of incredible activity that it is now. You can't go up, you can't go into Brown's office without finding somebody sitting in or demonstrating in his office. Some group or other is passing through there, and Brown darts out and talks to them. The whole sense of his administration is one of an administration which is not afraid to talk to people. Reagan and Pat Brown and Earl Warren would never be seen in Sacramento. You know, they would be seen surrounded by state troopers driving up in their limousine to the basement of the Capitol building and getting out and going up inside. Brown walks from his apartment across the Capitol Park to his office. People come into his office and demand to see him, and he comes out and talks to them and so on. I mean, that openness about him, I think, also is what is... It's Sacramento has become an exciting place. I mean, I do.
What role will California play in the presidential election, and what part in that role will Governor Brown play?
I think Brown will be one of the kingmakers at the Democratic Convention. What I basically see at the Democratic Convention is Carter, Wallace, Jackson, someone like Udall or Church, some liberal, going into the convention, all of them with strength, but no one with a majority or near a majority. There'll be enough uncommitted voters, or there'll be enough people with committed delegates that no one has a majority, and there will have to be discussions, bargaining, compromises will have to be made, deals, if you want to call them that, will have to be made. Some people will have to drop out, and the nomination's going to have to go to somebody. I see that in all those discussions, Governor Brown, I think, will play a substantial role. What I think will happen is that his decision to run as a favorite son or as a full-scale candidate in the California primary, at least, will mean that he will get somewhere between a quarter and a third, at least, of the votes in the California primary, which means that he will get the biggest block of delegates to California. So he will have somewhere between 75 and 100, or 100 and a quarter of the 200 California delegates as a result of his strength throughout the state. That will make him a factor to be dealt with. He will have a say in who's going to get the nomination, I think, because of that.
And that will in turn inject a little bit of the new politics into this presidential election?
I think it will, yes. I think Brown is himself serious enough, committed enough to his kind of questioning politics, as well as to his kind of egalitarianism, his kind of commitment to bringing new people into government, his kind of commitment to ending certain forms of social injustice will have to be taken into consideration by the candidates who want his favor at the Democratic Convention.